You're listening to your community radio station, KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, K284AL Haleiwa. It's time for In the Garden, On the Farm.
And In the Garden, On the Farm is made possible by Harvest Market, Kauai Marine and Mower, 808 Equipment Rental, and Aya's Garden Supply.
Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe in Hanalei is proud to support KKCR and its Ohana, offering organic groceries and produce, a cafe featuring fresh salad bar, hot meals and soups, fresh-made smoothies, and baked goods. Located in the heart of Hanalei, Harvest Market Natural Foods and Cafe, 826-0089.
Kauai Marine and Mower, located in Old Kapa'a Town, is proud to underwrite this KKCR program. Kauai Marine and Mower features Honda garden and lawn equipment, and also Echo Power Equipment, 823-0556.
808 Equipment Rentals, providing Bobcat rentals island-wide, with or without operator, including septic digging, vegetation removal, trenching, terracing, demolition, and more. Over 30 years of operating experience on Kauai. 808 Equipment Rentals in Molawa'a, 823-1000.
Aya's Garden, all-natural garden and greenhouse supply. In Kapa'a, down Kukui Street from the Dragon Building. Fertilizers, amendments, soil, seeds, garden and farm organic growing supplies. Open Monday through Saturday. More information at 822-7333 or visit Aya's Garden on Facebook.
Aloha and welcome to In the Garden on the Farm, your weekly radio program that cultivates the passion and knowledge to grow well with plants and animals. We're your hosts, Paul and Robin, and on today's show we spend the hour with pioneering mycologist Paul Stamets of Fungi Perfecti, perhaps the only household name in mycology, and this lecture is from the 2006 Lifestyles of Health and Sustainability Conference in Santa Monica, California. His lecture is entitled Mysteries of Mycology. So let's get to it.
I want to first acknowledge my wife, Dusty, who's been my partner, my love of my life, my dream come true, my comrade and co-conspirator on so many adventures in the past several years. I want to acknowledge my ancestors and my elders who have come before me. There's a lineage of knowledge that's passed downstream from elders to younger people. And as I get older, I can see how important that is. Dr. Alexander Smith and Dr. Daniel Stuntz were two of my mentors. They kind of picked me up when I was kind of like a mascot. I was 17, 18 years of age. And I hung out with these great scientists, and they inspired me. And I'm a very shy person in general. I have a stuttering habit, and so I really get fearful in front of large audiences. This audience is small, so that's probably good for me. But I want to, you know, first welcome you as earthlings, fellow earthlings, and also as mushroom people. Most of you may not realize that we are descended from fungi. Fungi are our ancestors. And there's breaking news in the December issue of the Journal of Eukaryotic Microbiology. 25 scientists co-authored, which in and of itself is a big event, a new seminal article erecting a new super kingdom combining fungi and animals together. And so Animalia and fungi have been joined together in a super kingdom called Opisthokonta. Not the best name, I agree. But it speaks to the evolutionary history that we share more commonly with fungi than we do with any other kingdom. So I want to take you sort of on a magical mushroom mystery tour. And it's, we all live, you know, as a very special lives. We are evolutionary successes. We should cheer because we are here today through billions and billions of years of cell divisions and evolution. And we are now, have achieved this status. And I oftentimes wonder if there's a United Organization of Organisms, otherwise called UOO, and every organism on this planet had a vote. Would we be voted off the planet or on the planet? And since this conference is about sustainability, I wanted to speak, you know, very specifically about how we can increase that aspect. And so I'm going to offer four practical solutions that can help. There'll be our paradigm shifting that can help steer this planet on a much better course. And at the end of the presentation, I'll announce a new invention that I have. I've been a little bit obsessive-compulsive about inventing, and I filed now 22 patents in the past 3 years. And I've decided that in order to create a paradigm shift, you have to steer the ship. You can be an advisor, and you can tell people great ideas and try to get them to do things. But, you know, in essence, if you don't control the intellectual property of your own ideas or that which can help other people, then you become subservient to other people's interests. And so this is why I've gone on the patent path. I'm really happy to say that I have 2 more patents. I just heard from my patent attorney. So I have another patent that's being awarded. And next week I have another patent that is coming online. So you can go to the USPTO.gov homepage and look up my patents. But enough of that. Can we have lights down further, if we could? This is where my wife and I like to go to church on Sundays. We love the old growth forest. We live outside of Olympia, Washington. We're only a few miles from the old growth forest, and we try to get into the old growth forest often. In the old growth forest are ancestral strains of fungi that exist nowhere else in the world. Understanding the value and importance of these fungi, I think, is instrumental to steering a path towards a better and brighter and healthier future. See if this works. Oh, good. It didn't. Okay. So this is what I'm going to primarily be talking about is mycelium. Now, mycelium is this fine fabric of cells that decompose plant and animal matter. You all have seen it, and if you haven't seen it, just go outside and find a piece of wood and just pick it up. And underground, underneath, you'll see this lattice matrix-like network of cells, oftentimes white, sometimes brilliantly colored, and it grows and it decomposes wood. And so what we do at our facility, and which mimics nature, is we take wood, we add mycelium, and we create soil. So these are the grand molecular disassemblers of nature. They decompose plant tissue and animal tissue, and the end consequence of which generates soil. In this process, lots of other things happen in the ecosystem. And the building of soil, as many of you know, it takes about 1,000 years to build an inch of soil. At our facility, we build soil like this in about 4 months. And understanding and the thickening of soils is directly related to biodiversity and increasing the carrying capacity of nature. The thinning of soils and loss of topsoils is exactly the opposite, where we lose biodiversity. I believe habitats have immune systems just like people. And in order to potentiate the host defense of habitats' immune systems, and we're a reflection of the environment that's given us birth, it's very important that we invest in biodiversity. How biodiverse is indeed the planet? This is where scientists are extraordinarily excited. In the past several years, the biological sciences are going through a revolution, and they're just absolutely mesmerized and astonished by how much biodiversity there is in nature at this point in time, and unfortunately, how much we're losing. So the mushroom mycelium oftentimes looks like this. This single strand can hold 30,000 times its weight. And so when the mycelium goes through the environment, it grips it. It prevents erosion. And as it honeycombs the soil, and these microcavities form where they become water pockets and reservoirs, it becomes a water bank. And then it slowly releases water over time. So these sponge-like environments infused with mycelium, I call them myceliated habitats, end up holding moisture. And as we all know, water breeds life. And so become these microcosms become universes of myriads numbers of organisms, without which the mycelium, if it's not there, is lost. Mycelium is the construct of the food chain. These are the networks that are able to move nutrients over great distances. So I spent many years as a scanning electron microscopist. I'm going to show you a few of my images. This is what the mushroom mycelium looks like under high magnification. It is only one cell wall thick, and it networks and it branches, seemingly undifferentiated. And that's why scientists for a long time, you can't identify a mushroom species by its mycelium. The mycelium will give rise to a mushroom like an apple tree gives rise to an apple. So the mushrooms are the fruit, in a sense, of this mycelial network. And so scientists thought, well, they're not differentiated. You know, they are interesting, but we don't understand how to study them. There's been an awakening, and indeed my life has been a series of epiphanies, an increasing awakening of the importance of these mycelial membranes. They infuse all habitats. from the tundra into the deserts. Of course, a lot more diffuse in deserts because there's less organic material, but nevertheless, there's fungi throughout the deserts. And the mycelial network, under the right conditions, will then coalesce. And then they form these little balls, and very, very quickly, that slide was in reverse, and a mushroom, and then it emerges. And this is the first primordial state of a mushroom forming. And then very quickly, these cells then burst. And mushrooms are so powerful, they can break through asphalt. They are actually are cellular explosions that are occurring over a few days. And there's a helical polysaccharide matrix. And in this polysaccharide matrix is gorged with water. And there's a one-way gate valve called the Dolly Pore septum that pushes the water up. And then the cells then expand. And they're so powerful that, you know, you can go to the asphalt and bang your fist into the asphalt and you'll break your fist. But mushrooms have the power of being able to break asphalt and concrete. And in doing so, it's caused millions of dollars worth of destruction on highways all over the world. So this is a soft, shaggy mane mushroom. You can crumble it with your hands. And yet it's so powerful that it's able to break asphalt. So most of us know mushrooms as the classic, you know, stem and gills. And there's a ring here that falls away from the cap margin. There are so many different types of mushrooms. We estimate now there's 150,000 species of mushrooms in a kingdom of fungi of 1 to 2 million. Of the 150,000 species of mushrooms, we've identified 14,000. So our ignorance exceeds our knowledge, as oftentimes it does, by several orders of magnitude. And this is just one example. We know so little about these fabrics, these cells, that give rise to life. So this is a piece of amber in a journal. It's the front cover of a journal called Mycologia. And in this amber is a fully intact mushroom. This is from the Dominican Republic from the Miocene period. It is 15 to 20 million years of age. The oldest mushroom so far that's been found in amber is over 90 million years old. Now, 90 million years ago, if you were walking through the forests and you looked down and you saw a mushroom, you'd go, ah, there's a mushroom. But if you walked around and saw a little mole, you wouldn't say, ah, there's a human. You know, this is how evolved these are. These are ancestral beings that have evolved their forms millions and millions of years before we evolved ours. So the universe formed about 13.7 billion years ago after a big party called the Big Bang, which most of you know about. It was a lot of fun, you know. I have faint memories of it. And then the Earth formed about 4.5 billion years ago. Fungi marched from the oceans onto land masses, which were devoid of any life, about 1.7 billion years ago. 700 million years ago, plants came onto land. Fungi are the vanguard species. They're the vanguard organisms. They decompose granite and rock. They precede algae as well as lichens. And then 465 million years ago, we diverged from fungi. And the antibiotics that we derive from fungi are very effective at fighting bacteria. But those with immunocompromised diseases, like AIDS, antifungal medicines tend to be very toxic, because you're more closely related to fungi than you are to bacteria. So we benefit from the resistance of fungi trying to fight back bacteria, which are trying to consume the fungi. So marching forward from 465 million years ago, which is our common ancestry, that's why I call you all mushroom people, then we go forward, and 250 million years ago, there's a great cataclysmic event. We have now entered the sixth great extinction on this planet. Two great extinctions, we have some pretty good records of what happened. 250 million years ago, an asteroid hit the Earth. The impact was so severe that it shrouded the Earth in dust and clouds of dirt. It choked out the sunlight. The Earth became dark, and fungi inherited the Earth because they don't need light. The plants that associated with fungal allies were naturally selected for, because they could get nutrients from fungi. So we marched forward, and that was at the junction of the Permian and the Triassic period. We marched forward to 65 million years ago. Most of you know, it's when the dinosaurs became extinct. Why? Because of another asteroid hit the Earth. the second major concussion, huge catastrophia, the earth became reshrouded in dust. Light was choked out. Fungi re-inherited the earth. Those two cataclysmic events steered our planet into a biological system of synergism, where we are no longer one organism, but we're an assembly, a synergistic blend of multiple organisms. You have 10 times more bacterial cells in your body, over 100 trillion, than you do have human cells. And fungi DNA is infused throughout you because we have evolved from fungi. Now we've pre-selected the beneficial bacteria that we need to help us. So you are no longer one organism. You know, you're a plurality of organisms of enormous complexity. And the more we study this, the more we understand the host defense potential that we must live within that concept of host defense, of potentiating your immune system, the immune system of habitats, because it's the plurality and the complexity of the biosphere that allows it to adapt to catastrophia and to change.
You're listening to In the Garden, On the Farm, and Paul Stamets.
So, marching forward. I'm going to show you a mushroom as it rots. This is a Russula mushroom up in the old growth forest in a meadow. It's past its prime. Mushrooms are trying to fight bacteria, but then they give up themselves. After they sporulate, then they rot. And my work has shown that the mushrooms pre-selectively determine the bacterial communities that the mushrooms will allow to be rotted upon it that are effective in helping the plant communities ascend, fix nitrogen, produce more canopy, as a result, more debris trails that benefit the progeny of these mushrooms. These mushrooms take a long-term view, and humans are incredibly biologically myopic, taking a short-term view, and this is something that we need to get away from. You know, we need to think about our ancestors, we need to think about our descendants. And this, I think, a lot of us share that in common. So the mushroom then, as it sporulates, the spores germinate into mycelium, and it melts into this subterranean mycelial network. And a single cubic inch of this mycelium, there can be more than 600 miles of cells. So every footstep that you take is covering hundreds and hundreds of miles. And I like to say the journey of 10,000 miles is about six steps, something like that. So the mycelial network, I spent years in front of the scanning electron microscope. You know, and I'm sort of a hippie from all my life, and I think about different things, and, you know, I have great ideas, and as we all do. But the more I looked at this, the more I thought that these look like neural synapses, and that these are neurological nets. And the more that I began to understand these membranes, of course they're sentient. When you walk through the forest and you're breaking wood, you are a catastrophe in motion. And the mycelium and the fungi, because of the diversity, are reaching behind you, trying to catch up. And so, I feel it is no accident, and I deeply believe that the mycelium is Earth's natural internet, and that the invention of the computer internet is a repetition of a previously proven biologically successful evolutionary model, rewarded over time. And these type of structures that we see are specifically designed for information sharing, nutrient flow. I believe mycelium is a sentient, is intelligent. It gave birth to us. If we are intelligent, that which gave us birth also, de facto, must be intelligent. And so the computer internet, it looks like computer neurons. This is from Hank Morden. Look like neurons, human neurons, excuse me, computer neurons. This is an astrocytic photograph by Hank Morgan. And then this is from NASA, and this is the Virgo Consortium, which is a cluster of galaxies that intergalactically are strung together with masses of matter, also forming these networks. And even going further out, this is from Scientific American, and this is the cobweb of dark matter. I'm an amateur astronomer, and it's very disconcerting to learn a few years ago that 97% of the matter in the universe you can't see. You know, and this conforms to string theory. And so going all the way out, it has dawned on me that matter begets life. Life in the simplest forms are single cells that build chains. Chains network and divide. Pretty soon this synaptic mycelial network or this internet archetype is pervasive. This is the way of nature. We are not the only life-giving planet in the cosmos. mathematically is virtually impossible. There are thousands of other Earth-like planets spread throughout the cosmos. And I believe that we'll find fungi throughout the cosmos because of this simple paradigm. So where is the largest organism in the world? Well, Dusty and I live here. And this is the Columbia River is there. And the largest organism in the world is in this location in these mountains. So I hired an airplane, and I flew there, and I found it. Now, this is the largest organism in the world. This is the outline of the mycelial mat. This is the mycelial mat in eastern Oregon, 2,200 acres in size, 2,400 years old. And yet the mycelium is only one cell thick. The largest organism in the world is only one cell thick. We have five or six cell layers that protect us from infection. How do these fungi do this? It's because they're in constant biomolecular communication with their environment. They're constantly sensing, developing alliances, synergisms, symbiosis, and this is a marauding parasite. It's actually 12,000 years ago, at the end of the last ice age, around 10,000 years ago, as the glaciers receded, they scrape away all the soil. And these fungi come in, and there are lenses of soil that survived, and plant communities grew up, and they died, and the fungi rotted them. The soil got a little bit thicker, the lens got a little bit larger. Over 10,000 years, you know, we develop an old-growth forest that's growing in less than 2 feet of soil. And so understanding how these membranes work in the ecosystem, they take long-term view, because as the organism grows and the soil thickens, the carrying capacity of the ecosystem increases. More foliage, more wildlife, more microbes, more habitat. And this is something that we need to invest in, is biodiversity and encouraging the regeneration of soils. Whoops, I don't know how this is jumping around here. Okay, so there's the mycelial mat again. Now I'm going to talk about four inventions that I've been involved in that I've created. One of them was in Bellingham, Washington. There is a contamination of soil from diesel spills and from trucks and buses stored over 50 years. The Department of Transportation was finding the Department of Ecology was levying fines against the Department of Transportation because they had a toxic waste site. This site is lifeless. It is full of toxins. Plants will not grow there. There's no worms. And so the Battelle Laboratories, who I've been working with in the previous 3 years, we went up there and we inoculated the soil with mushroom mycelium. There were three other piles. One was a control, one was treated with bacteria, one was treated with chemicals. 4 weeks later, they came back to discover what they'd see if there's been any change. This is stinky hydrocarbon oil gasoline saturated soil. Just, 20,000 parts per million of these hydrocarbons. The mycelium, which is here, absorbs the oil like a sponge. And then, as the oil is absorbed, the mycelium, it produces these extracellular metabolites, sweat. They're huge capillaries for water. Mycelium can move water over great distances. And as it exudes these extracellular enzymes, they break carbon-hydrogen bonds, which is the basis of hydrocarbons. So we came back between weeks 4 and 5. The first tarp was pulled back as a control pile. It was stinky, dead, and neutral. No life. Stunk like oil. Second pile with bacteria. Same story. Third pile with the chemical treatment, same story. And then we came to our pile. It was covered with hundreds of pounds of oyster mushrooms. Some of these oyster mushrooms were 12 to 16 inches in diameter. Any of you know oyster mushrooms? These are very happy oyster mushrooms. These are very, very large mushrooms. So the soil was analyzed subsequently, and 20,000 parts per million of these hydrocarbons were reduced to less than 200 in 6 weeks. The mushrooms sporulated, and they attract insects, and insects laid eggs, and then something else occurred, is that then plant communities returned. Now, birds came in. They were going after the developing larvae. They brought in seeds. There were also windblown seeds. But then our pile became an oasis of life. And it really underscored my present philosophy in my new book, that these fungi are healers. They're environmental healers. They come into these ecosystems, and they condition it for other life forms. So the fungi, the mushrooms rotted, bacteria took over. So bacterial remediation occurred. Plants came in, phytoremediation occurred. So I think these are keystone organisms that can lead to habitat restoration. in a way that we can take brown fields and make them into green fields. You know, Ford Motor Company has a lot of brown fields. They can really benefit from this. So this was, Battelle Laboratories and I worked for 5 years together. We published a number of peer-reviewed articles, several hundred articles. It's been well documented, and I don't have time, unfortunately, to go through the science. But what I was able to do in my book, and I have 25 of these charts, I put mushroom species here and toxic waste here, chemical toxins. I also have it with all sorts of other contaminants in the environment, biological, like bacteria. And so you can mix and match. You can find what toxins you have in your environment and create a mycelial a mosaic that's customized to the toxic waste you have in your backyard or in your community, all by using mushroom mycelium. One of our strains broke down VX, which Saddam Hussein did use. And this was published in James Defense Weekly. And so one of my mushrooms was very active in that. That quickly became black box, and I didn't hear much more about it. But they gave me credit that it was my strain. That was nice of them to do that. So the second invention I want to talk about is on my mycopesticides. And I have to give credit to Bill Nicholson, who's a friend of mine and a great visionary. He's a very wealthy man. But he understood that there is inherent power in nature. And I convinced him that, and it's something that I believe in, which is natural intelligence. I believe nature is intelligent, and that we can tap into these natural intelligences and this brain bank of experiences over billions of years, and being able to use strategies already invented in the theater of evolution and nature. Now, I want to segue just a little bit, because my mother's a charismatic Christian, and I've been to so many charismatic Christian, you know, meetings through my childhood and when I was a teenager. And I told my mother, you know, I believe nature is intelligent. She was quite alarmed, you know, because she had different views. But my mother's very, very great heart. She's a wonderful lady. And she's actually a charismatic Christian leader. She's a shaman. She wouldn't use the term, but she leads a rather large Christian community, very affluent, in Winthrop, Washington. And I had this epiphany. And it was all because of the creationists, you know, arguing, you know, that the creation theory should be taught in the schools. And I said, Mother, I had this epiphany. I got to tell you. And she goes, what, Paul? And she really believes that I'm kind of tuned in. And she goes, Mom, evolution is God's intelligent design. And she goes, oh, Paul, what a wonderful thought, you know. I think somebody should make it into a bumper sticker, you know. And I think this is what I want to do, is bridge polar opposites. You know, we see the destiny of our children's health being primarily concern. And that brings a bridge between all sorts of different communities. So one of the things Dusty and I live in this, we lived in this pathetic house. Andy Weil, who's my best friend, said it's the worst house he's ever seen a person live in North America. It was built in 1910. It was a flat roof in Washington. And when it rained, it just like, it's 12 buckets were catching water. It was just mold growing everywhere, and carpenter ants were consuming the house. And it was just an enormous parade of carpenter ants all the time. There was holes, and when the wind blew, it blew through the house. And, you know, and the sawdust piles would show up in various places. And Andy was sitting on the couch one day, and sawdust was coming down. And Dusty doesn't like me to mention this, but I'll mention it anyhow, because we had a cat that would take a crap on the roof, you know. So there's extract of crap coming down to Andy Weil, going, what's going on? Damn it, you got to rebuild this and tear down this house. So finally we did. But anyhow, so sorry, love. It was a really bad house. You get the idea? I mean, you can relate to that. So, but then I went to the EPA.gov homepage, and I looked up an environmentally benign approved fungi for controlling termites. And that did not target beneficial insects. And so I found this fungus that they recommended called Metarhizium, otherwise pronounced Metarhizium, is an entomopathogenic fungus. It infects insects. And it doesn't kill bees and doesn't kill ladybugs. It's specific against termites and structurally damaging ants. And so I got this fungus, and we have a laboratory complex. We have a 10,000 square feet of clean room. We have four laboratories. We have 20 or more laminar flow benches. These are real high-tech environments I do lots of in vitro propagation. So I'm really a lab rat, and if I'm not in the old-growth forest. And I got these cultures, and I was horrified. They were like penicillium molds. They're covered with molds. And so the industry, in looking at how these were used, they never made it in the 80s and 90s to market, because the insects, you would brush them with these spores, and sure enough, it would kill termites and ants in the laboratory. But when you put it into a little bait trap around a house, the ants would come up, or the termites, and they'd get close, and they'd smell the plague because they were close to it. They'd turn around and run away. And so they never made it to market because of the avoidance property or the repellency of these spores, which the ants knew were pathogenic. And I thought to myself, through the evolution of life, this does not make sense. The fungus is repelling the very insect it wants to kill in order to grow more of this fungus. Well, that's antithetical to its own existence. I said, but that's not the way of nature. The way of nature is based on the feminine, the Aikido approach. And the spore method that all these other scientists and very big companies were involved in, more spores, more missiles, more death. And that's a very male Machiavellian view towards life. I said, no, this is the fungi have got to have a different way. The feminine, attracting, sublime, and subtle. And so what I did is I took these cultures and I morphed them into a state that didn't produce any spores. So this is the mycelium. These are the two same cultures. This one's about 6 or 8 weeks away from this one. So I developed the mycelium because I thought, if the ants know that this fungus is pathogenic and to avoid it, the fungus knows that the ants know. And that was my big epiphany. And so with my daughter and with my wife, Dusty, we got a little Barbie doll dish. And we put down the mycelium on rice. This is the actual image. This is part of the house. You know, there's also debris. And every morning, there'd be a large pile of chewed-up house there. So we'd vacuum it up every day. So I knew they were coming there. There's an insect party in your house at night. They're mostly nocturnal. And so then we put this out around 10 o'clock at night. And then around midnight or so, my daughter walked by, and she had to go to the restroom. And she walked by, and she looked down, and this was swarming with ants. The ants picked up the kernels of rice that were covered with mycelium, took it back into the house, and then about a week or 2 weeks later, no more sawdust piles, no more carpenter ants. And I had actually gotten rid of them. So I told a friend of mine who's a patent attorney about this whole problem. He goes, you may have a patent. And so sure enough, here's an example of the ants swarming over the mycelium. And then the ants then consume the mycelium, and they become mummified, and boing, a mushroom comes out of their heads.
This is KKCR, Hanalei, KAQA, Kilauea, In the Garden on the Farm, with mycologist Paul Stamets.
This has now been involved, I've been involved in 4 years of research with numerous laboratories all over the world. And this ant is stimulated into climbing when it's infected. And so there's an impulse to climb the top of the canopy. This is actually this is a photograph from Lawrence Gilbert, and the ant is compelled to climb the top of the canopy, then launches its mandibles into the leaf, and then a mushroom pops out. That ensures the spores get spread far and wide. So this impulse to climb is a mechanism that the fungi has created, these sort of adrenaline compounds that makes the ants climb to the very top of the forest. So this is the remnants of our house that was being torn down. I put a happy face here just because it was a pretty destructive image. The house did not survive, but the ants did not come back for 4 years. And so I'm happy to report that I received a patent on this. And the patent was approved December 9, 2003. It's effective against carpenter ants, fire ants, subterranean termites, and promotion termites, which are all over Asia and now New Orleans, of course. And then I started working further, and we engaged this investment group led by Bill Nicholson, infused us with some capital, and we got involved with all sorts of other big companies. And I put my environmental sort of diploma on the side saying, I want to work with these companies. You know, they really want green solutions. I made conditions on my patents on licensing. They couldn't quash it. You know, there's all sorts of other strict environmental conditions. And then we started working with all these different companies. And then we started making more mycelium and more strains. And then we said, well, let's start making extracts from that mycelium that was on grain. We made extracts. This is an arena. These are Formosan termites. And sure enough, with four choices here, the Formosan termites stream towards the extract. Not living mycelium now. It's just an extract, like an essence. And so we found a super attractant. And the super attractant, this is skipping slides here, folks in the back. The super attractant, when we diluted it 500 times, it potentized it. So for any production company, if you could dilute something with water 500-fold, you reduce your cost 500-fold. So we can treat a house for about 25 cents, maybe 42 cents with a first-class envelope or something like that. But it's very inexpensive. So I have now widened this, and I started to treat more social insects. Social insects are social insects that have a queen. These are queen-based colonies. The mycelium in this technology is so friendly to the queen that in two examples, they actually picked up the queen in the nest and they enthroned her in the bed of mycelium. The queen spreads the fragments of mycelium to all the workers who become like little mushroom growers, and they spread the fragments throughout the nest, which becomes mummified in this mycelium. It's a big, like, opium den, I guess. I've never been to one. But for about 2 weeks, then they engage and they gorge this mycelium, then this lethargy occurs. Then after about 2 weeks, boom, the whole nest is killed. And then what happens? A few of them sporulate. And when they sporulate, they repel future invasions. So your house then has a host defense, a repellency against future invasions that lasts for many, many years. So I tried this on other insects, and I've just been approved. And next week, at the USPTO.gov homepage, I've been approved for all social insects. All insects that have a queen, which is a tremendous triumph. Thank you so much. This has been a long, long journey. And so it gets bigger and bigger. So I tried it against non-social insects, against mosquitoes and dung flies and fungus gnats. And sure enough, I had activity against them. So I'm going for the whole kingdom now, which is about 2 million species of insects. My dream is to be able to bring a locust plague into a 55-gallon drum. We can steer insect migrations. And in mosquitoes that are carrying malaria, we can also have two methods of controlling disease-carrying insects. And this is something that segues into my next talk. So this is my best buddy, Andy. All of you know him because he's become so famous. Andy discovered me when I was about 19 years of age, and he and I are best buddies, and he kind of cultured me in many ways. He just knew that I was onto something, and he has a strong belief in the intelligence of nature, natural systems, and the Asian approach of treating the immune system as a system. Not the magic bullet target-specific approach, but enhancing the immune system. And the Asian medical philosophies are so apropos, and they really become the accepted paradigm in combination with conventional therapies. So Andy's in one of the rooms with reishi mushrooms. And this is another reishi-like mushroom called Ganoderma aplanatum. And this is Cedar, who is the son of two of my employees. And this is a wood conch that is about 30 to 40 years of age. It's growing in the old growth forest. And Steve, who showed me where this wood conch was, and he said, well, I guess you, I said, I want to clone it. And he had the idea, well, you have to pick this old conch off the old growth tree. I go, no, we don't have to do that. All we have to do is take a small fragment the size of that pointer, bring it back to the laboratory, and I can then take the tissue out and put it into a petri dish, and I'm capturing that cell line. We're not doing any GMO work. We're just taking that which nature has already presented. And by then getting it into culture, I was able... Oops, this is the skipping slides again. I'm sorry. I was able to grow it. So that mushroom still exists in the old growth forest, and yet I have a culture of it growing in our laboratories, which means that if that ecosystem is devastated, like I have saved that strain. It's called the artist conch because you can draw on it. So I created more charts, and these are all in my book. And these are against, this is a cross-index of mushrooms and targeted therapeutic effects, whether it's cancer, whether it's infections, whether it's arthritis, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Mushrooms are like miniature pharmaceutical factories. They're producing a whole slew of novel constituents, most of which heretofore unknown in science. And so their molecular configurations and what makes a species and this assembly of these vast molecular constituents which are put together, which you call a mushroom, but when you look at it biochemically, they're rich in all these novel natural compounds. So one of the mushrooms that Dusty and I have focused in on is this mushroom. It's called agaricon. The Latin name is called Fomitopsis officinalis. Dioscorides first described it in 65 AD as a treatment against consumption. There's over 2,000 years of use of this mushroom as an anti-inflammatory and as an agent to fight arthritis. This mushroom exists now only in the old-growth forests of Washington, Oregon, parts of Northern California, and British Columbia. There's two or three places in Europe, but because the old-growth forests have been cut down, this mushroom is now thought to be extinct or nearly extinct. So I got involved with the U.S. Defense Department BioShield program about three and a half years ago, and I couldn't talk about this openly until the past year. But I sent them 250 plus mushroom extracts, similar to what I did with the mycopesticidal strains and story there, and I sent them for testing. And then we started getting the research back. The U.S. Defense Department's primary concern is the spread or the weaponization of viruses. And the weaponization of viruses can have enormous impact, trillions of dollars worth of damage, as we all know. You can track nuclear weapons and fuels a lot easier than you can track a virus. And so they mandated and they funded with many $28 billion, I believe, the Defense Department. So the U.S. Defense Department, NIH, NIAID, and U.S. AMRID, U.S. Army Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, synergistically put together a program, and they then called out to scientists to send in your samples. I started sending in hundreds and hundreds of samples. I personally, Dusty and I, have spent over $300,000 of our own money on the BioShield program, the preparations for the samples, over the past several years. And so I'm delighted to be able to tell you about some of the results. This is another agaricon, that's his name. It's about 37 years of age, just about the age of Dusty. I think Dusty's more beautiful, but, you know. But these are growth rings. And this thing grows in the old growth forest, and each year it gets a new ring. So we went down here and we made a clone of it. We took a piece of tissue from the bottom, grew it out in petri dishes, made extracts, and then we sent it to the BioShield program. This mushroom also has the Venus of Willendorf form. And so it's been associated primarily with the materia medica of women medicine. And so in the Doctrine of Signatures, things that look like, you know, a woman or a heart or something like that is usefully employed for that purpose. So it has this Venus of Willendorf form. It's also essential to the origination myth of women with a Haida, who would carve this mushroom to these spirit guardians that are placed on graves of women and men shamans. And so we started getting the research results back, and actually Federal Express delivered this big package, and we're laying in bed and we're flipping through the research results, and like 80 pages of, you know, no activity, and then active. A few more pages, active. I was going, Dusty, we have activity. And they're screening against specifically pox viruses. Now, those of us from European descent have an embedded, inherited immunity partially against smallpox. Why? Because it was noticed by Dr. Jenner in the late 1800s when milkmaidens told him, an English physician, that they noticed that their community did not get smallpox. But they would get these black little blisters called cowpox blisters on their hands. That conferred a partial immunity. If there's a smallpox outbreak today, you know, we are no longer immunized against smallpox as of 1968. So those who were born after 1968, you are totally susceptible. And those of us immunized before, well, a variant of smallpox virus now would make that immunization totally useless. So 30% of us from European backgrounds would die from smallpox, 30% of us would become blind, 30% of us would become maimed, and 10% of us would go unscathed. If you're a first people, the Native Americans here in North America had no contact with cows. They had no exposure to cowpox, so they were decimated. 90% of the first peoples of that origin are susceptible to smallpox. They die. And let us not forget the United States and the British government were active in bioterrorism against indigenous peoples. They spread it through smallpox-infected blankets, often at the time the treaties were signed. Gujau, who's a friend of ours, who's the president of the Haida people, told us that 50,000 people went to 500 on the Haida Gwaii Islands, otherwise known as the Queen Charlotte's. They don't like to call it the Queen Charlotte's because that's the name of the ship that brought in the smallpox. And this is off the coast of British Columbia. And they went from 50,000 people to less than 500 in 3 years. Absolutely devastating. Now, the Christians who brought the scabs, if you converted to Christianity, you got a scab. And so the shaman, Haida and the first people's medicines of the shamans didn't work. And so they lost face. And so they were marginalized within their community. And it caused the fractionation of this community. Gujal told me that they had a kill ratio of 8-1 against Europeans. They were so effective at getting rid of the Europeans that the Europeans and And the British and Americans realized far easier is to send in a smallpox-infected blanket or an individual to decimate the community and then come back in the spring or the summer. And you could walk into these villages, oftentimes located at the ports where the rivers flowed into the oceans, military strategic ports. That's where the salmon would come in, the bear would come down. And so they use this as a military strategy. So the threat of bioterrorism is still a very, very big threat in this country. So this is related to the HIDA myth, the origination of the HIDA. So we started getting our research results back. And Dr. Earl Kern, some of you can't read this, he's the foremost smallpox expert with the BioShield program. It says compounds that have a selectivity index, or two or more, are considered to be active. 10 or greater are considered to be very active. Lo and behold, I sent in all these strains of Fomitopsis officinalis, that mushroom that the HIDA revered, and the selectivity index against pox viruses, vaccinia, variola, and cowpox, hit 20.9. 29. Highly effective. You can go to NPR. This was announced. We had a vetted press announcement from the U.S. Defense Department. In and of itself was amusing because I called up my handler at the U.S. Defense Department, and I said, we want to do a press announcement. We are by contract allowed and encouraged to do so. The BioShield program tells you to make press announcements if you do have good activity. They want to justify their budgets. And so we made this press announcement, and I said, well, listen, let me understand. How many samples has the BioShield program received so far to be tested against potentially weaponized viruses? West Nile viruses included, Bichinde, VEE, lots of other viruses. And they said, well, I can't tell you that. It's national security. I said, okay. More than 2 million or less than 2 million? And they go, I'm sorry, I can't tell you that. It's national security. I said, okay, well, more than 200,000 or less than 200,000? He goes, oh, way more than 200,000. You know, it's like somewhere between 200,000 and 2 million is the national security, you know, litmus test. I'm not sure exactly why. So 6 samples have been selected by the BioShield program as being worthy of pursuit against pox viruses. We have the first and only activity of a natural product against pox viruses ever. Of the 6 samples selected and approved for the CDC for mammal tests to want to go that far, 2 of our samples are from this mushroom that is exclusive to the old growth forest. So I believe we can very effectively make the argument that we should save the old growth forest as a matter of national defense.
You're listening to In the Garden on the Farm and Paul Stamets.
So that inspired me. and I think, some of you know, some of you don't know. I was a logger for 3 years. I dropped out of college. Young men do this. They try to kill themselves by finding a really dangerous occupation. I don't know why. But we do this, you know. I mean, women really are like, you guys are really awful. You know, so I went up into the woods, and I cut down the old growth forest. And so some of the best environmentalists I ever met were loggers. I mean, people may find that astonishing, but they didn't want their steelhead streams cut. You know, they didn't want some forest cut. You know, they had a job, but the logging industry demonized the environmentalists and used a spotted owl as their target. It was a dumb thing for the environmental community to elevate the spotted owl as their mascot. It just made all the lumberjacks, you know, have a lot more fun, you know, beating up this little small owl. They chose the bear or the cougar or something macho. That would be a far more effective campaign. I feel a debt to the old growth forest. But I also, 3 of the guys that I was working with, 3 of the 6 of the guys I was working with were killed. And I really saw that, you know, this is the problem with polar opposites, is that there is a concerted campaign of one extreme against the other extreme to demonize. There's a bunch of chatter and cacophony of opinion. And most of us are in the middle. And so looking at the old growth forest now, the economic cost of a smallpox outbreak in the United States would be in the trillions of dollars. It trivializes the value of old-growth lumber in the old-growth forest. There's only one mill in the old-growth in the Washington state that can even mill old-growth. They've all retooled. But why they're retooling? Because the trees are getting smaller. Why are the trees getting smaller? 10,000 years to build 2 feet of soil. We cut the old-growth forest 3 times in 100 years. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize that forests are not America's renewable resource. You know, you have diminishing returns, you have premature decline, the trees topple over in wind when they're only 40 years of age. That's why the lumber industry is cutting them younger and younger, because they'll be blown down by wind. Then they'll rot and they can't use it as lumber.
So diminishing returns is now the pattern. And the biggest lie of the logging community is that trees are America's renewable resource. It's just frankly not true. So we started testing against other viruses. And I couldn't show this until it was my first presentation in public of this slide, because I filed lots of patents on this. Lo and behold, we have marginal hits against H5N1 from Fomitopsis of fish malus, our great ally in the old growth forest. We also have really good results now against West Nile virus. We have 8.5. Anything over 2 is considered to be highly active. We have results. We have realized that these extracts here are presented as a natural product. They'll be given at the same dosages as ribavirin and other pure pharmaceutical antiviral agents. They're being given at the same micromolar amounts of concentration in these cell walls. And so our activity of our natural products approaches that of a pure pharmaceutical. Now, I have to be very careful what I say. I'm very happy with a company called New Chapter who sells our products in wild oats. This strain is on the shelf in wild oats. Fomitopsis officinalis was in a product called Host Defense, which I trademarked. And so this is the beginning. It's not ethical to do smallpox epidemiological experiments on humans, obviously. But these are the best tests that the in vitro specialists can devise at this point in time. Now, we'll go to monkeypox and cowpox and the mousepox. Those are other pox viruses because they're all in the same family of orthopoxes. If you're exposed to one and you develop these blisters, you have a partial immunity against other orthopoxes. But this is the good news about this is because 2,000 years of history of use of consumption, you know, shows the FDA that they're non-toxic. And the fact that we've had about 4 or 5 million consumers out there of this very product with no adverse reactions is a real-time test of non-toxicity. The jump from in vitro tests to in vivo tests is a big jump, you know, admittedly. But we are now steering the path to actually developing a whole strategy of natural products to potentiate the immune systems of first responders, people in hospitals, which are breeding grounds for more contagions, as most of us know, in communities. There will be a viral epidemic soon. If it's not SARS, if it's not bird flu, if it's not smallpox, it's on the horizon. When the organism exceeds the carrying capacity of its ecosystem, diseases proliferate. That is the way and rule of nature. It's inevitable. Finding that the genome of these higher fungi, which were scoffed at by the pharmaceutical industry, and people who are mycophobic say, oh, they're funny mushrooms. The mushrooms are food, or they're magical. We don't understand them. They're no use medically. That's been our intellectual property landscape. That's been wide open for us to explore. And that's why I've been so active in pursuing these patents. So I'm going to conclude with my fourth invention. I filed a patent on this 4 years ago. And this is an invention that everyone in this room can make use of it. This is a way of combating global warming. It's a way of teaching our children about sustainability, about being able to grow ecosystems. And what I utilize, since we have a mail order business, is a cardboard box. This is my daughter, Ladina. This is Mike, our UPS man, who gave me permission to be able to show his image. We all get a lot of cardboard boxes every week. Well, Dusty is a gardener. She's got the green thumb and I have a white thumb. And she puts down the cardboard on the ground to suppress weeds, as many of us do. And then as you pull up the cardboard, what do you see? Fans of mycelium. So I started marching mycelium and running mycelium on cardboard. And then the ideas started coming together. I'm going, wow, this is very interesting. And before I go on, I refer you to the Science News April 15th issue, where it is defined in here that no longer can you say a plant is a plant. It's a plant-fungus symbiote. All plants are infused with threads of fungi. And you can't separate the two out, and that's the way, again, of nature, because of those catastrophic events of the asteroids when they paired up. So we all get lots of cardboard boxes. So I had this idea, and I filed a patent on it, and I call it the Life Box. And I actually trademarked thinking outside of the box. bad pun. So, and it's the way to regreen the planet. And we all make ecological footprints. And so, in the ecological footprints, come back here, in our footprints, as we walk through nature, we break sticks and fungi gobble them up, plants, then then follow us. And so you have the communities of plants following our impressions on the ecosystem. Oh, why aren't you dropping? Okay, so then you take a cardboard box, and it could be the Quran, it could be a Bible, it could be a Vita, it could be Dell computers, right? I'm name dropping here. And my view is to reinvent the cardboard box as an ecological footprint. And I infuse within the corrugations of the cardboard box seeds of environmentally or ecologically appropriate plants infused with fungi, endophytic mycorrhizal and saprophytic fungi, that then encase the seeds with this mantle of mycelium that is beneficial, that prevents diseases, that absorbs water, that gives it a host defense. And then this is one mantle of mycelium. And these are eight different seeds that are very, very happy. You can develop the life box that have grassland plants that are become more rare. You can have vegetable gardens, which I designed for Afghan refugees, which never got off the ground, but that was my intention, a Quran in a box, for instance. You could have it for farms. You could have it for old growth forest in a box. I have a grandson now. He's 3 years old, but when he comes to the age of awakening, around five, I'm going to take him out and I'm going to plant a life box with an old growth forest in the life box. And I'm going to tell him, your grandson and great-grandson will be able to walk through an old growth forest that you planted. Because my epiphany when I was a child was a day in kindergarten and in my Dixie cup, the sunflower germinated and set up its shoots and this cotyledon leaves spread to the sun. That's when I felt like God. I understood for the first time the birthing of life. And someone mentioned earlier the importance of that childlike enthusiasm of being excited about nature. This, I think, reinstills and rebirths that idea. And so the life box, I put corns, beans, and squash in this one with some onions. And then after they germinated, then I separated them out into a bathtub, a toilet, and a kitchen sink. And then this is it 4 months later. Boom. And out of this, we got enough seed to be able to start a small farm. About 30,000 seeds came from that one life box. So everyone talks about global warming and the increase in carbon dioxide because of fuels and everything else. But what about replanting? What about regreening the planet? 1% market share of cardboard boxes in the United States, it can cover 25,000 acres of surface area. That can have a huge impact. And if you go to a store and you're buying shoes, and up there you might have Nike, or you might have Timberland, or you have Reebok. Well, if Timberland has their shoes in a life box, where all of us Americans and people around the world feel guilty about how much waste we have, for an extra dollar, you can buy your product on life box, a box that will teach your children about life and rebirth, sustainability, that will help regreen the planet, that will tie them back into nature. It could be wildflowers in a box if you don't have the land. You know, what are people going to do? They're going to vote for the life box because they'll vote for the planet. So I think this invention alone, if nothing else, can reinstill in the future generations the importance of life systems and ecosystems. And as we walk through nature, we do have an impact. We are part of this biological community. The earth is alive. We are a plurality of organisms that are living in synergy with the earth. Thank you very much.
This has been In the Garden, On the Farm with your hosts, Robin and Paul. If you liked our lecture today and you'd like to know more about Paul Stamets, check out his website, fungi.com, or email him at info@fungi.com. Please tune in again next week for more stimulating conversation on our relationship with the life of the land that gives us life.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays.